This is The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly. More woe for Liverpool, this time losing at bottom of the league Nottingham Forest. Dean Henderson's cap, wayward finishing and open on the counter. A massive win for Steve Cooper. After years of being stunted by Real Madrid, Casemiro is finally allowed to go forward. His arch-backed neck-flexing header rescues a deserved point for Erik ten Hag. Newcastle are fourth after winning at Spurs. Hugo Lloris following up his fruitless heroics in midweek with some fruitful generosity. Arsenal drop points for just the second time this season. More good news for the Hasenhüttlers out there. Just how much was Steven Gerrard holding Aston Villa back? An unshackled Leon Bailey and friends take just 15 minutes to see off Brentford. Elsewhere, confirmation that Erling Haaland is stronger than Adam Webster. Leeds are in trouble. Wolves are in even more trouble. And Everton just turned into Brazil 1970. Is Alex Iwobi the new Rivellino? All that plus the Women's World Cup draw. Your questions. And that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, Robin Cowan, welcome.
Hello, Max.
Hello, Barry Glendenning.
Hello, Max Russian.
Hello, Nick Ames.
Hello, Max.
Right, let's start the City Ground. Nottingham Forest 1, Liverpool 0. Neil says, the economy is in meltdown. We have an energy crisis. People are only lasting 40-odd days in high-profile jobs. Forest are beating Liverpool and keepers are wearing caps again. Are we reliving the 1970s? Gavin says, should Liverpool sack Klopp, install Gerrard as their new manager, then fire him to turn their season around? We'll get to Stevie G in a bit. And Autumn says, are Forest enjoying a keep-the-old-manager bounce? What a brilliant result, Barry, for Nottingham Forest.
Yeah, a brilliant result for them, and one I suspect very few people saw coming, despite Liverpool's fairly ropey start to the season. Forest had to obviously ride their luck at times. Virgil van Dijk missed three excellent chances, I think it was, and they had other good goal-scoring opportunities as well. Trent Alexander-Arnold's header is one that springs to mind. I think Roberto Firmino had a chance, but yeah, it was a brilliant performance from Forest, showing huge signs of improvement. And while Steve Cooper stressed after the game that it's just a win and it's only 3 points and we're nowhere near where we want to be, I think it's really worth probably a lot more than 3 points insofar as you take into account the confidence it will give the players. You know, if we can beat Liverpool, then surely we can beat anyone. Something they've not really shown up to now, apart from what was their opening game of the season. I think they won. But yeah, hats off to them. And it was a big cut. Steve Cooper had been getting a lot of heat from refusing to drop Brennan Johnson, who hasn't impressed particularly this season, having lit up the Championship last season and being a huge factor in Forest promotion. So he dropped him, brought in Tayo Awoniyi, and he scored the winner, having spent 6 or 7 years at Liverpool, but being constantly farmed out on loan elsewhere and never having played for them.
Do we accept a non-celebration celebration from someone who's never played for the opposition team, Robin?
It's an interesting one because I did their game against Fulham and he scored then and didn't celebrate. So
Oh, right.
I think it's just a kind of maybe a sort of Balotelli sort of vibe, like this is just what I do. I'm hoping he didn't not celebrate because Liverpool, because he doesn't really have much history with them despite being on their books. But yeah, I just think Steve Cooper deserves so much credit. I think he's a proven manager, you know, of personalities as well as a really good tactician. He's pretty much had success everywhere he's been. And if anyone is going to crack this, I think it's going to be him. I think the fans are still with him. And he's just done, obviously, as Barry said, it's just one win and they may go on a run of loads of defeats now. But I just do think he's quite special, Steve Cooper. And if anyone can do it, it will be him with this Nottingham Forest side.
I am basing this on just sort of 15 seconds that I saw on Match of the Day of a 1-1, but he did come across really well after. He obviously celebrated at the final whistle, and he did say, look, I owe Liverpool a whole lot. They picked me from Nigeria, they scouted me, and maybe he didn't get his break there. So like, he was very generous with his sort of praise of what Liverpool had done. Nick, you were nodding furiously as Robin was talking about Steve Cooper.
Yeah, I think Robin's spot on. And I think if you look at the job that Steve Cooper did last season for Forest, it was coming in and really managing to pull together and get the best out of a very disparate squad that had come from all sorts of places, lots of loanees. There wasn't much cohesion to it, arguably too many players, and getting them together and getting them up. And it's not really too dissimilar this time around. Now, there's a lot of conjecture about who brought some of these players in, and the recruitment team obviously got given the heave ho a week or two ago. But it's pretty much a sort of slightly more elite version of the same job. You've got a load of players that have been put in your path, and you have to get the best out of them. And so you know, nobody better to do it on the evidence of the past year or so. And there was a few signs. I was at their game with Brighton on Tuesday night.
Oh, so was I. Goodness me.
It was the worst game I've been at this season, Robin. Maybe the same for you. So I can't believe we're raking back over it here. And we're not going to, because this is meant to be a sort of broadly an entertainment programme.
Broadly, Nick.
They had no attacking threat at all against Brighton, did they? And so it's like they just started to build a little bit more of that in this game.
That was exactly it. And they were a lot better off the ball, a lot more robust. And you saw a lot of the steel that they hadn't had in previous games, which, like, Forest earlier games this season were appointment viewing if you wanted basketball craziness, you know. And you have to go back to basics, don't you? And get that defensive work right, get that shape and structure right, which I think is what Cooper did with them last season too. And you could just see at Brighton that happening. And he said that after that Brighton game, that's not really us. I want more from us going forward. Sure enough, we got that against Liverpool. Could even have had another couple of goals, I think, especially in that second half on the break. And I think, yeah, you can't judge it on a couple of games, but that was a big win. And you can see how he's trying to pull things in the right direction. And by the way, the atmosphere in the City Ground sounded absolutely fantastic. I mean, that's a proper football stadium and a proper football club when it gets going, isn't it? And it just sounded like it must have been incredible to be there.
Barry, what are Liverpool?
What are they? I think at the moment they're a once great team that are in obvious decline. Jurgen Klopp made 5 changes for this game, and perhaps this showed a lack of strength in depth. But, you know, with better finishing, they probably should have won the match. You know, I did say before the season I thought they might struggle to finish in the top four, and I still think they might struggle to finish in the top four, because I have a feeling Newcastle might finish in the top four. Manchester United, I'm not convinced yet by them. So, they're a very good team who aren't as good as they used to be. That's what they are, I think.
Yeah, I laughed at you, Barry, when you made that bold prediction. And I'm not laughing now. Well, I am now laughing. Yeah. I've made myself laugh, which is it's a good skill. It's a good skill to have in life, isn't it? Any other thoughts on Liverpool, Robin? And I mean, because it feels like, and obviously, you know, Liverpool are not going to make a drastic decision. Jurgen Klopp is a wonderful manager. He's done so much for that team, and actually to compete as they have with Manchester City is a real achievement in itself. He's allowed a duff season in the league, and they could still win trophies. But it is interesting to see, you know, just how quickly, like, tides kind of turn and people start talking about them in different ways.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I still think people are, I don't know how long it's going to go on for, but I think people still feel like they can get in the top four because they do have Klopp and they do have, you know, a really good team. But they're odd, aren't they? Because they've you know, fantastic win against, is it Rangers, and then Manchester City. And then they kind of struggled a little bit in midweek against West Ham. And then, yeah, just, I think it's, as Barry said, it's just a squad that's slightly older. Mane clearly is quite a big miss. They had, I don't think Nunes was fit for this one. So it's kind of a lot of stuff going on. But they've not won away this season. Like, I think that's, I find it quite interesting when teams have a ridiculously good record, either home or away. Because I think Brighton are different. Brighton have really got not a very good home record and they're good away. So I don't know what it is, if it's tactically something they're not quite doing or... I mean, but we saw this, they kind of... Was it 2 years ago after they ran City close? Or after, actually, no, after they won the title, they had a drop-off, didn't they? And they just about got in the top four after Alisson scored from
That's
a corner.
It, yes.
So they kind of flip-flop a little bit. They just... You know, as Klopp said, they can't maintain it as much as City because they're not owned by a country. It's just going to be more difficult for them.
You xenophobe. Sorry, Nick.
No, sorry. I think going to that away record, I think it was their first back-to-back away defeats in 5 years, I think I saw, which is fairly notable. And then it's a bit like, I know... You see it with teams, don't you? I mean, you saw it with Leeds, who we'll come to later, and under Marcelo Bielsa, that maybe when a team is so tightly wound and going at such full tilt for so long, it's like an elastic band. You go past the elastic limit and you can't become elastic again just like that. It's not that simple. And I won't torture that metaphor any further, but I think that's kind of what's going on with Liverpool. And obviously, you can't look past the injuries too. Lots of injuries. Diaz, a big miss now, of course. Several others. But it's increasingly looking like the dreaded season of transition for Jurgen Klopp.
Let's go to Stamford Bridge. Chelsea 1, Manchester United 1. The most drawn fixture in Premier League history. One of those stats that I absolutely could not care less about. But there we go. Maybe it's interesting to somebody. Manchester United, Nick, were for these, certainly for the opening of this game, were brilliant. Sort of started where they left off against Tottenham.
Yeah, good passing, good energy, good speed, good movement, I thought, up front. Couple of good chances first half, wasn't there? There was a pretty big miss by Antony, I think, where Silva whites had kept his eyes but put it past the post. Kepa made a good save, I think. Was it from Rashford? It might have been. But the energy was there, definitely, which you haven't always seen. And the movement and the combinations. And Chelsea, by contrast, were quite hard-working, quite compact. I think Graham Potter had to change things up in game for the second week in a row, didn't he? Think he changed from a back three to a back four and kind of tightened up a bit in the middle with a little bit of joy, sort of stem the flow a bit. But most of the real kind of proactivity and creativity came from United, and you didn't really see Chelsea create too much across the whole game, which I think is going to be a bit of a concern for Potter. I mean, obviously, Reece James, from out on the right, does provide them a lot when he's fit. But then they come out of that game feeling unfortunate and not to have won it. And they would have won it if it hadn't been for a millimetre ball crossing the line. And it was nearly Kepa's best save of the last week, which has got, well, a week and a bit, which there's quite a large selection of those. So, yeah, one of those where both teams can feel happy and disappointed, really. A little bit dissatisfying.
It was a brilliant header, Barry, wasn't it?
Casemiro, is that absolutely outstanding? Yeah. The power he got on it from the position he was in. And Kepa, I've heard Nick there say it was almost a brilliant save. I've heard others say he should have done better. I thought the criticism there was pretty harsh. But I think he did his damnedest. I'm not sure what else he could have done under the circumstances. But yeah, an outstanding header and a little bit lucky. But, you know, I think another draw was probably a fair result. I thought both teams were quite negative, actually, more concerned about not losing the game than winning it.
Isn't Casemiro one of those players that Manchester United usually ruin, you know, in recent years? You know, they comes with a big fanfare and then doesn't deliver. So I'm hoping it will be different for him, because clearly he is absolute quality. But like, kind of like a Schweinsteiger or Di Maria, and usually they just kind of fade into the background without doing anything.
He does seem to be attacking more than he did for Real Madrid. Obviously, I didn't watch Real Madrid week in, week out. I don't know what his goal scoring figures are, but he seems to be getting into those positions. And sort of, I don't remember him sort of arriving in the box and scoring headers. Sort of good news for England, Nick, is Luke Shaw looks like he's playing really well. Slightly, I don't know if this is worrying, but like, I wonder, was it Glenn Hoddle who said Andy Cole needed seven chances to score a goal? I'm starting to feel that Rashford is just a bit head down, hammer it as hard as he can, lacking that sort of ultimate bit of composure.
Yeah, have like one of my first half, didn't he? I think, and time's ticking for him to show that a bit of consistency and form that will get him over the line to Qatar. But yeah, definitely, there's something not quite there. Maybe he's overthinking it, which is often what you see with forwards. On Luke Shaw, you're right. I thought he was very impressive too. Seems to have a bit of the fitness and confidence back. I think he had a shot in the first half as well, didn't he? Or a burst forward that almost resulted in a goal. So, good news for Southgate that two players who, you know, have been out of the reckoning a bit are looking fit, but Rashford, time's running out a little bit.
Is he less clinical, or are we now, because we get to see Erling Haaland every week, judging other strikers by his standards?
Good question. And I suppose in my mind, and you know, history plays tricks on us, in my mind, when Rashford arrived on the scene, he was scoring those chances. You know, he had a bit more confidence about him. He was hitting the corners. You know, it's not the sort of, you know, it's not Timo Werner, who, as far as I can remember, when he was first at Leipzig, every shot he had went in, and now he just literally can't possibly score. But it sort of feels like that. But I might be doing him a massive disservice. There were lots of people saying, I think Roy Keane was leading the charge, saying Ronaldo would have scored that chance. Ronaldo would have scored that chance. Ronaldo would have scored that chance, without ever alluding to the fact that if Ronaldo was playing, that chance might not have actually happened, right? because it's different. It's quite fascinating to see Roy Keane's sort of love for Ronaldo and failure to criticise him at all.
To be fair to him, he's not alone in that. Quite a few of Ronaldo's former Manchester United teammates just steadfastly refuse to criticise him in any way. But it doesn't matter, but Ronaldo has obviously played right into Erik ten Hag's hands by storming off in a huff last week. Because Ten Hag is now well within his rights not to ever include him in his squad again and just get rid as soon as possible.
It's just funny though, because Roy Keane's like he wouldn't be one for a flashy player, is he? It's kind of strange seeing him defend, and also someone who did that.
Roy Keane can't really criticize someone for storming off, can he?
Yeah, Mick McCarthy might have something to say about it. Yeah, that's true. I just find it really strange.
Yeah, I have rumours linking Ronaldo with Chelsea. I just cannot see it happening. It'd be absolutely hilarious. So I play Ronaldo and Aubameyang up front in a 4-4-2. It'd be good, wouldn't it? Anyway, that'll do for part one. Part two will begin depressingly at the Tottenham Hotspur Stadium. Hi Pod fans, Football Weekly is supported by FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small town Welsh football club has finally been promoted to League Two after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher league. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenge and rise again into League One? FX's Welcome to Wrexham premieres May the 2nd on FX. Stream on Hulu. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. We have a live show on the 17th of November, our Christmas special. It should be fun, and hopefully you will all come and make it fun. And then we'll go and have a beer afterwards. Me, Baz, Lars, Sivertsen, Ellis, James. If you would like tickets, go to theguardian.com/guardianlive. And I'm afraid that even if we do sell out, I will still tweet about it on the hour because we're live streaming. And so until we sell 7 billion tickets, then I have to try and sell more tickets. But yeah, wherever you are on earth, you can watch us. And you can watch it live or you can watch it later on. You'll get sent a link and watch it any time in the following week. Tottenham 1, Newcastle 2. Newcastle into the top four. It was a close game, one of those fine margins ones. But But Barry, a deserved win for Newcastle.
Yeah, a deserved win. A win that didn't surprise me, and a statement win. I think it was a statement win for Newcastle and a statement defeat for Spurs. So Newcastle had already drawn with City, lost to Liverpool. I think, if I remember correctly, they were a little unlucky to lose that one. Drew at Manchester United, and now they've beaten Tottenham. So they've beaten one of the big six this season now. And Spurs, they've drawn with Chelsea, and a game they should have lost. I don't know how Chelsea threw that one away. Lost against Arsenal, lost against Man U, and now they've lost against Newcastle. So I think it tells us a lot about both teams in that Spurs are kind of bang average, playing about par, beating teams you'd expect them to beat and losing against teams that they would expect to be doing better against. And big result for Newcastle. I was at White Hart Lane the last time I think they beat Spurs. That was Steve Bruce was in charge. Those days Newcastle fans will remember very fondly. Joe Linton was still a striker, and he scored the only goal of the game. I remember that. And how things have changed. But a much more significant win for Newcastle, this one, I think. And as you say, pretty fully deserved.
Bit of controversy about the first goal. I mean, I thought, even with my very Spurs biased head on, I thought, Robin, that is a goal. And Hugo Lloris has just been a bit shit, which he carried on being. Goalkeeping's Ben Foster disagreed. He tweeted, if an outfield player knocks it past an opposing player and they're in the way like that, it's a foul, capital letters foul, every single time. The goalkeeper is the player in control of the ball. If he beats the striker to the ball and the striker's in the way, unfortunately, it's a foul. There's nothing the striker can do about it, but it's still a foul. He was very exercised by this. Is that the goalkeeper's union? What did you think?
Yeah, he's paid his subs for his membership, hasn't he? I think it's fine just because the fact that it was kind of like front on, wasn't it? Usually if it's kind of like a shoulder barge or something, then it should be a foul. But no, I just think Lloris had his sort of once... What are we saying? Monthly? Couple of monthly sort of rush of blood?
Yes, I'd say it's more than once a quarter.
Yeah.
But it's not quite once a month. And he was brilliant against Manchester United.
Yeah.
But no, I mean, it didn't matter in the end.
But that's what's so frustrating about him, isn't it?
He has that. And he also, there's nothing more depressing from a Spurs perspective than watching him float a pass under hit to a fullback and give someone plenty of time to chase him down, which is what happened for the second goal. I know Almiron had a lot to do and Clement Longley just disappeared, but it was very frustrating. Nick, you had your hand up very politely.
Yeah, I think on the goal, you see that foul given a lot in general play or all over the pitch when a player sort of genuinely, and it's sometimes genuinely, sometimes a body check, but often when they genuinely can't get out of the way, and they're pulled up for blocking. And every time that happens, I don't like it very much. I think it's slightly harsh. So my feeling when I saw that was probably get chalked off, but I don't think it's particularly fair. And then that's obviously not what happened. So I think it was probably the correct decision. And just reward for what you were saying just then, Hugo Lloris for an outstanding keeper who's had an outstanding career and has been an outstanding sweeper keeper that definitely has quite a few of those in him with the high-risk game he plays.
It's not Newcastle. I think, personally, it does make me sad, what's happened to them. I feel very conflicted because they were I really liked them growing up. I'm sure it was my favourite player. But like just concentrating on what Eddie Howe has done, I think the best thing that he's done is made existing players loads better. Like you mentioned, Joe Linton, Longstaff, Fabian Scher couldn't get a game, and then Miguel Almiron, but maybe that was more a drunk Jack Grealish dissing him. That's all he needed. And look at him. I mean, he's just absolutely oozing with confidence. It's just great to see.
Tom sends an email saying, hi folks, Spurs fan here, not impressed by Tottenham's performance, deeply unimpressed by the ownership situation at St James's Park, but I couldn't be anything but massively impressed with Newcastle on the field of play. Spurs have spent the season so far looking either dynamic and unhinged or more often dull but coherent. Today, Newcastle were the best of both worlds. Eddie Howe insists he wants to focus on football, not Saudi Arabia. In my book, that's not good enough, but in purely footballing terms, he's going above and beyond. Any person who can turn Fabian Scher into Franz Beckenbauer deserves a huge measure of sporting respect. And the secret dad says, I say this as a Spurs fan, but should Spurs just accept they'll always be Spursy, no matter who the manager is, and therefore just quit the league? And it is hard to gauge them, Barry, because they're still third. They're top of their Champions League group. It'll be fascinating what both these teams do in January, because all Conte says is, I don't have enough players. Let's wait until the window. And obviously Newcastle now, in this promising position, should be able to attract even better players.
Yeah, and I do wonder, given the inevitability of Newcastle's rise to prominence with their under the new ownership, will we have a big six? Will someone have to drop out of the original big six? Or do we have a big seven? I don't know. I'm not quite sure.
I was going to say, during the Soccer AM Glory years, it was a big four. And then I think, I can't remember who was breaking into the big five, but we had a massive five made, like huge, like it was absolutely huge. Is it time for the big five? And someone was, I was going to say, is it time for the big five? And then it would just pan out to this massive five on the sofa. And not for the first time, I completely ballsed up the inline for the gag and it ruined it. And someone had gone to all this trouble. The props guys had spent like weeks building this five and there was no need for it anyway.
So someone's going to be building a massive seven soon.
Exactly. Yeah, of course. Southampton 1, Arsenal 1. Only the second time this season Arsenal have dropped points. Nick, you braved a rail replacement bus to make this game. What a hero. I mean, how was the bus to begin with?
The bus was good on the way there from Eastleigh. Mm-hmm. Eastleigh right. Seems like a very nice little market town to I'd never been, to Southampton, mm-hmm. which is very near. And on the way back, I circumvented the bus by getting an Uber.
Wow. That's very Ben Fisher. You sort of, that's the most Ben Fisher, I think. That's the sort of detail that he gives us. So it wasn't, I thought you were getting a bus from London to Southampton.
No.
You were just getting a 5-minute bus. I'm not impressed with that. I thought you really had gone above and beyond. What did you make of the football match?
I was going to give you more Ben Fisher-style detail, but let's crack on. I'll leave that to the master. The football match, when it happened, was a good game, actually. For 10, 20 minutes, you thought Arsenal were going to pulverise them, because Arsenal did their usual thing. They started very, very quickly against the Southampton side, who were pretty low on energy, low on personnel too. Obviously they already had two or three injuries, and then Kyle Walker-Peters obviously is now out for a while. Che Adams, who won the game against Bournemouth a few days previously, was only fit for the bench. Ainsley Maitland-Niles on loan from Arsenal, not eligible. So they looked very thin, and it looked like Ralph Hasenhüttl, who reverted at the start to his sort of tried and trusted, you either call it 4-4-2 or 4-2-2-2, don't you? To his tried and trusted. And it all felt like they were going through the motions a bit. And Arsenal could have scored twice before another Granit Xhaka right-footed half volley from a right-side across. And that was an absolute carbon copy almost of his goal against PSV Eindhoven. And you did sit there and think, how many? Then Hasenhüttl made and a fair play to him, because he's had quite a lot of stick, isn't he? He's definitely borne the look, as he tends to around this time every season, of a man under heavy pressure. Switch things back up, switch to wing backs, put Oyunusi to wing back, Pero to left wing back, who'd been at full back before. And things sort of steadied up a bit. Gabriel Jesus missed a couple of good chances for Arsenal. There was a volley from a lovely scooped Odegaard pass.
So nice,
Odegaard tries that once every game, and this was just such a lovely little first time scoop. Good and important save by the keeper. And you kind of think at half time, Southampton haven't really done much, but they have got themselves a foothold in the game. Now, what can Arsenal do? And we saw last week, didn't we, that Arsenal in the second half at Leeds, in that stormy game at Elland Road, absolutely rode their luck and just about came out of it. And you thought they might get away with that here, because Saints aren't up to much. But let's see. You have to steer clear of turning this into a thing by just talking about it a lot, or it being an actual thing. But I was quite interested after the PSV Eindhoven game. Saka had played and started that game, as had Gabriel Jesus on Thursday night. And a few people were a bit surprised because Saka's started every game by two. And Saka against PSV was fantastic. Best player on the pitch, 85 minutes. Nobody could touch him. Absolutely brilliant. And I asked Mikel Arteta afterwards, is that really sustainable? Can he keep playing these games and then playing in the Premier League 3 days later? And Arteta said, well, look at the top players. They play 70 matches. They play every 3 days in the season and they're ruthless and they make the difference time after time. There's no fitness coach in the world who tells me that they can't do it, which I thought was surprisingly bullish and a bit old school and very interesting, whether he meant it or not. And I just felt we saw in the second half, Saka definitely faded. Gabriel Jesus probably puts one of those chances away when he's at his sharpest. And there was just a little bit of tiredness and legginess crept in. So, look, we can't catastrophise about Arsenal too much because they've dropped points for the second time. Boo-hoo. You know, they can wring their hands about it from the top of the league. But there was just a few signs that maybe Arteta's got to rotate a bit more assiduously over the coming weeks if they're to keep this level up.
Oh, well, and Nick, that is an excellent summation of that football match. Mark says, was Barry surprised to see that Theo Walcott still existed and that he'd returned to Southampton?
I knew he was at Southampton. I knew he still existed, but I don't think he's featured particularly prominently this season. So unlikely to make the plane for Qatar, I'm seeing.
I don't know. There's 50 spots, isn't there, at the moment?
It's true. It's an easy jet charter flight. 300 people on it. Let's go to Villa Park. Dave says, objectively, how funny is it that as soon as Gerrard leaves Villa, they turn into prime Barcelona? I love Gerrard as a player. I have nothing against him as a manager, but 3-0 up after 15 minutes, after months of being useless, it's undeniably hilarious. Barry, he's right.
Oh, it was an astonishing vindication of their decision to fire him. And wherever he was watching it, if he was watching it, he must have been absolutely horrified at what he was seeing. And on Match of the Day, they flagged up Villa's average goals, expected goals, shots on target, big chances so far this season, and then the equivalent yesterday. And I mean, the differences were, there were chasms between them. It made for horrific reading for Steven Gerrard and his agent. It was just quite astonishing. And Aaron Danks was in charge of Villa. I must confess, I'd never heard of him before yesterday.
Yeah. Important to say, not Aaron Banks, yes, the arch Brexiteer.
Yeah. I did a double take when I saw the name. And then, oh, it's Danks, not Banks. So he changed the formation. He dropped John McGinn, the captain, which, you know, dropping the captain was one of the things that Steven Gerrard got in trouble for early in his tenure. And it was just quite remarkable. I was watching the Arsenal-Southampton game in the pub and just, 1-0, 2-0, 3-0. I was like, what the hell is going on? I want to watch this game. But, it was just a remarkable... I'm speechless, Max. I'm lost for words.
Wow, finally.
I like to picture Gerrard, like, kind of maybe trying to enjoy a nice Sunday lunch with his family and then just seeing an alert just on his phone go, oh, for fuck's
you'd have
sake.
To watch, wouldn't you? You'd have to watch. He's got a nice pad in Portugal. I like to think he was in Faro, you know. Yeah. He just come off the golf course and thought, I'll just flick it on, see what they've done. Mike says it should be written into every Premier League manager's contract that they have to do a shift on co-coms for their team's first match after they've been sacked.
Yes, yes.
It'd be a great chance for them to vent or try and explain how their struggling team are now 3-0 inside 15 minutes. And look, I suppose, Nick, look, it could be an aberration. You don't know. Aston Villa have some good players. They're Premier League footballers. Leon Bailey arrived with a lot of promise and he showed it in that 15 minutes, didn't he?
Yeah, he was brilliant down that left flank, which maybe is where he should have been put all along. I mean, look, Villa were at home, very good for an hour against Chelsea the week before. I was there, and I think Robin and I must have been following each other around the country recently because I was covering that one. And Gerrard might well have reflected when he got off the golf course in Faro that if they scored, well, given one of those goals from yesterday, the week before, things might be looking very different for him now. So they are able to attack and go through the gears. Got some really good flair players and a lot of strength in midfield too. I thought Douglas Luiz, from what I've seen of the game, because it was going on parallel to the one that I was at, it looked like Douglas Luiz was running the show in midfield there. And I think maybe with Gerrard in the end, he just kept trying so many different things. I think he never let one shape or 11 or pattern stick for a succession or a run of games. And if you do that, I think a lot of coaches would say you confuse the players. Like, players start to have doubt about you. They have doubts about themselves. Things become less crystal clear. But if a new guy comes in and just says, right, you do that, you do what you're good at. Leon Bailey, get down the left, put balls in, jink at people. Simple, but it works. And I think we saw that yesterday. And the way they started that game was fantastic. But again, they did have it in them. And we saw it a week previously.
That was the first Villa game I'd done, the game against Chelsea. And they put in a really good performance. But at the final whistle, it was pretty toxic. Because I thought, oh, you know, there's some encouragement here. But no, I mean, a lot of the fans had already turned on him. And then obviously the Fulham game, where you have to make that walk from the tunnel to the dugout, that's a good sort of litmus test as to how your popularity is. And it was just interesting how the fans, it didn't matter that they'd put in a good performance, they were fed up already with Steven Gerrard.
Grant says, can you give this a mention, Max? Warmed an old cynic's heart today, this did. Aston Villa tweeting out, you might have seen Danny Ings come out with headphones on, with the mascot also with headphones on. Riley Regan, who attends the Aston Villa Foundation's Ability Counts Disability football sessions, walked out with Danny Ings this afternoon. The striker joined his mascot in wearing headphones to block out the noise. I've chatted to Danny before. I think we both have. Barry's a very nice man. He's one of the nice people in football. They do exist, and we should probably celebrate the good things in football occasionally, given the bleakness. I don't know if you read Jonathan Wilson's column in The Observer about how depressing this all is. Well, you know, hopefully, maybe there are good people littered through it somewhere. That'll do for part two. Part three will begin at the Etihad. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. Now, the Football Supporters Association Awards are back, and we would like to retain the trophy, or we won't mention it at all, the podcast after the awards ceremony. Go to thefsa.org.uk. Think of all the good things we've done for you. And this is free, this podcast, you know, and if you don't vote for us, I'll be sorely disappointed with you. Because this is a tough job. He says sitting in a nice house, just have to watch football on the telly and chat shit about it. But look, we still like the award. You can vote for Robin Cowan, Commentator of the Year. Robin, it's a big moment for you, isn't it?
Oh, it's a privilege. It'll be an honour to lose to Peter Drury. Absolute honour.
I voted for you, Robin. You can vote for The Guardian, Newspaper of the Year. You can vote for David Squires, Online Media of the Year. He's up against The Athletic. Come on, Squires can take down that behemoth. Barney Ronay, Susie Rack are both up for Writer of the Year. The Guardian Football Weekly is up for Podcast of the Year. And you might as well click on the warm-up for Radio Show of the Year, because it was very funny when we won it last year, because Barry was absolutely shit-faced and just stood on stage going, this show is rubbish. And it just shows to what the rest of you should have a long, hard look at yourself while 606 all sat there looking quite miffed at Barry. Anyway, let's go to the Etihads. Manchester City 3, Brighton 1. Neil says, as someone who grew up with the football of John Beck, good for you, Neil, what an education that was. How much do you love to see Man City going to the dark side, enjoying some filthy Route 1 goals, just glorious stuff. Next step, Mahrez playing left wing and just sticking it in the mixer. I mean, the first goal, Nick, I said on the radio yesterday, it reminded me of Speedball 2 on the Amiga. It's a hilarious goal, isn't it?
Yeah, there's also cold showers now in the away dressing room, and they do unspeakable things to the halftime tea as well. it was an excellent kick by Edison. We know he's got that in him, lovely and long and flat. And yeah, when you've got a player like Haaland who will bounce off him as he did in finishing the goal, because I think it needed a VAR check if I'm right, then yeah, you've always got a chance of being able to release him and just see him rampage through like that. And it was like a sort of cheat code, wasn't it, on sensible soccer or something like that. It was pretty insane, but fair play. And City, it's another example of how City are able to absolutely mix things up with Haaland up top.
Yeah, you just needed some robot paramedics to come and pick Adam Webster up and just sort of take him off the pitch. And the thing is, Barry, he's not N'Golo Kante, right? He's a big lad, Adam Webster.
He is, and he looked quite sheepish as he appealed in vain for a foul afterwards, as if, you know, oh God, I better appeal, even though it's slightly embarrassing that he swatted me aside with such ease. But, if you're the Brighton owner, obviously losing to City away is not terrible. But Roberto De Zerbi is still looking for a win after five games. And the thing is, there's a few teams in the Premier League who are playing quite nice football, but can't score often enough and let in too many soft goals. Brighton are one of those teams. Wolves are another. Leeds are another. And obviously, Brighton aren't in any danger at the moment, but the other two are. And what do you do if you're Roberto De Zerbi? Because, you know, it's like when Potter was there, the team are playing quite well, but just struggling to score goals. And there's not a huge amount you can do if you're a manager, short of buying someone new to score goals.
Can I just get a shout out to John Bruin's Get It Launched campaign? I'm very much backing this for Manchester City's goal and Liverpool's winner against Manchester City. I know Lars Simonsen's very much behind it as well. I just think it's perfect. You know, you have that political tagline, three words, get Brexit done, you know, education, 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 get it launched. And I'm sure Nadeem Sahawi will be backing it at some point today.
Do you think, and we've sort of chatted about this before, do you think Pep hated that goal?
Yeah, I'd love that. He's kind of punching the chair. disallow it.
What is long balls?
I mean, it's actually, Emi Martinez did a brilliant pass to Ollie Watkins, I think. Like that skill of goalkeepers, some of them, I mean, I'll exclude Hugo Lloris from this wafting. He's only got a sand wedge. He doesn't have that club in his locker. It's such an interesting new development in football in the last sort of 5 to 10 years.
I would love it if after Ederson had sent it long and Haaland scored, that just Pep got, is it Scott Carson on the bench? Just put up Ederson's number, off you come, and send on the goalkeeper and do what he's told.
Well, we did start this chat with, you know, talking about John Beck, and he did substitute Steve Claridge for cutting inside. Like, I think he set up a goal, but like, it was like, no, your job if you're playing on the wing is to get to the byline. There's no cutting inside in this team. Off you come, mate. Anyway, Kevin De Bruyne scored a lovely goal. I suppose the interesting thing about that is nobody was surprised that Kevin De Bruyne scored a lovely goal, because he is a sensational footballer. Everton 3, Crystal Palace 0. When did Everton turn into Brazil, Nick? I mean, all their goals were brilliant. And I think the Iwobi touch to McNeil is absolutely sensational.
I've got a friend who's a very big Everton fan and probably listening to this. And he texts me every couple of weeks at the moment saying, Alex, Iwobi is absolutely unplayable at the moment. You've got to watch it and believe it. And I must admit, I wasn't watching very much and rarely believed it. But I've been paying extra attention in recent weeks, and I've got to say he's been transformed into a player who, again, one of those who has the confidence to maybe try things he wasn't trying before, you know, has a lovely deft touch and everything's coming off. And that goal from him and Dwight McNeil, I mean, great run inside from McNeil, the kind of gliding run, a bit more direct than we sometimes see from him, because I've sometimes kind of not seen it with Dwight McNeil. Very incisive run, lovely little back heel back to him, and superb finish. And it's the kind of football that Everton fans have been craving for a long time. I know it's quite a facile point, but it's true. And they delivered against the Palace side who didn't really turn up. And good also to see Dominic Calvert-Lewin. I thought good surging run, first goal of the season in I think only his third or fourth appearance. Gareth Southgate in the stands, I think. Now, whether that was too late to get him on the 50-strong entourage to Qatar, we will see, or even the final 26. But definitely a bit of a reminder that he's there and can do it. But good signs for Everton and some good swashbuckling football that maybe they've missed.
Steven Gerrard would have been furious about that game as well, wouldn't he? On Calvert-Lewin, it's interesting, that touch to get it past Mark Gay was really beautiful. He does so well for the goal because he wins the ball back, has that touch and a brilliant finish. It is a question for Gareth Southgate, is who is the striker if Harry Kane does his ankle a week before the World Cup? Because Calvert-Lewin is obviously has his fitness concerns, but Southgate has had faith in him. Callum Wilson is playing really well and is clearly a brilliant striker if he's fit. Ivan Toney is sort of the guy with the shirt at the moment. Not that he came on the pitch with the shirt.
I would have Calvert-Lewin behind. I would have Toney, then Callum Wilson, then Calvert-Lewin. I think Bamford's completely out of the reckoning now. He can't hit a Ballon d'Or at the moment. But three of those four all really struggle to stay fit, so that's a worry. But I think, yeah, you'd have to say Ivan Toney, probably.
Yeah, I'm just thinking from Gareth Southgate's point of view, he really is, he's pretty steadfast in kind of his loyalty. And even though Ivan Toney was taken, he didn't play him. Whereas Callum Wilson, even though he's not been picked, he has actually played and scored for England, you know, quite a while ago. And I agree. He's such a natural finisher, Wilson. But yeah, you would be worried about his fitness. But I think he's fabulous. You know, he's fantastic. But that's a really... Say Harry Kane was, you know, that's it. He gets injured in the next game and that's it. I mean, that is... Oh, it would be a nightmare in terms of the phone-ins and stuff.
Are we leaving out someone really obvious? Rashford.
I mean, or Tammy Abraham was, but he seems to be out of the
Les
picture
Ferdinand.
As well now.
We've forgotten Les Ferdinand. Robbie Fowler. Robbie Fowler's the most natural finisher. Come on, everybody. Ridiculous.
And Teddy Sheringham has that extra yard in his head.
He really does. Barry, we disagreed about the second goal, didn't we? I mean, it's a wonderful move, but we disagreed about whether it could be in the goal of the month category.
Yeah, you say that. It was a wonderful move out from the back. I think it was, I counted 12, 13 passes. It reminded me slightly of Sunderland's wonderful goal, that one goal of the month team effort for one goal of the month for September. And I noticed actually they got presented with the trophy for goal of the month, and every single player who was involved in the move was there for the... It wasn't just Jack Clark, the goal scorer. So that was a nice touch. I thought it was right up there with that one. Not quite as good, but, you know, not far off it. But you say because Mikulenko's shot was saved and Anthony Gordon only scored in the follow-up, then it doesn't count.
It's a lovely move, but that's all it is. It can't have any more than that. You can't put that to the life of Riley. It's just not acceptable. let's go to the Elland Road, Leeds 2, Fulham 3. Richard says, don't record too early. I want to hear your reaction to Jesse March getting sacked. Jay says, when do we say for certain Leeds are going down? Right now is my answer. No win in 8, Leeds into the bottom 3. Would you say things are desperate for Jesse March, Robin, or not? I really hope they stick with him, but...
Me too. You know, he's had his critics, but I mean, personally, he's a really nice guy. He's always polite, even when they've... You know, we've lost, which you can't say about many managers, just from a personal point of view. But no, I felt so sorry for him. That second goal went in. It looked like he was going to be sick. I mean, on the bench,
it was terrible.
I know, it's just awful to see. And
it would be funny if he had that kind of Cartman influence. Like, literally every time Leeds could see the goal, he just projectile vomits.
That would be great. Oh man, yeah. I mean, I don't know what's wrong. I mean, because they do create quite a lot, but they concede, and the goals they conceded were really bad, weren't they? I mean, that especially that Decord over Reed header. It was just completely, you know, he's not the tallest, but he was just absolutely free as a bird. I don't know what it is. They're just kind of ball watching, and yeah, it's just not working. But I don't. short of getting a kind of, you know, Sam Allardyce figure in, which wouldn't go down well, I don't know what else they could. I'm not sure if getting rid of Jesse Marsh would really do much at this stage. They clearly, I think they're really missing Calvin Phillips, aren't they? Because he's that sort of defensive, every, you know, he was everywhere. And also his range of passing. But I mean, it's interesting because, I mean, it seems like not that long ago they won against Chelsea. You know, really, that was a fantastic performance against Chelsea, and they haven't won since. So, yeah, I mean, it'll be interesting to see what Leeds do. But, yeah, it's tough for Jesse Marsh. I do feel for him.
More nice people managing football teams. That's just, it just should be the top one. Are you nice? You can have the job. Fulham are seventh, Barry. Haven't been to those heady heights since the Roy Hodgson days. And, you know, they've got really like players like Harrison Reed, who I had given no thought to until this year. Just brilliant footballers. And it is incredibly impressive to be seventh in the league for a team that we basically all wrote off at the start of it.
Yeah, absolutely. And they have a very impressive midfield. Harrison Reed, João Palhinha, and Andreas Pereira is a player reborn, having failed to hack it at Manchester United. And Alexander Mitrovic, obviously, it just shows the importance of having a striker in form. And, I mean, that goal he scored was a soft one. I think it was Luke Ayling let him score at the near post from a corner, and it's very sloppy defending. But I remember when Marco Silva came first to, was it Hull he started at? Mm-hmm. And we were getting all these chin stroking, navel gazing pieces about how great he was going, this guy no one had ever heard of from Portugal was going to be. And he didn't really impress at Hull or Watford or Everton, but he's doing a good job here so far.
Finally, Wolves 0, Leicester 4. Leicester are good again. So we're worrying about that for no reason. Two interesting statistics. Jackie Oatley saying a striker has not scored for Wolves in their last 22 Premier League games. It's an extraordinary statistic, isn't it? Lars Sivertsen, in their last two games, Leicester City have had 5 shots on goal and scored 6 times, which is incredibly efficient. What do we want to talk about? That Yuri Tielemans strike, Baz? Wow.
Well, I think it's, you know, anytime someone scores, we're looking for a mistake. Who messed up? Whose fault was it? And I think that's one of those goals where nobody messed up. You know, was it a cross or a free kick or a corner came in, someone headed it clear, and then just bam, this is an unstoppable shot. And I don't think anyone was to blame. It's just one of those goals that nobody could have done anything about. And an absolutely brilliant strike. And you could see Yuri Tielemans' post-match interview that he was incredibly proud of himself for scoring it.
What I loved about it was that there's a free kick taken and cleared out, and he's got a way to go to the ball, but he watches it all the way. He's got his eyes on the ball, knows exactly where it's going to fall, where it's going to bounce up, and then just puts his foot through it. And if you're a kid watching that technique in terms of lining up a long-range shot, it is absolutely textbook and perfect, as, of course, it is the clean finish.
John says, should Wolves think about appointing a permanent manager before 2023? They've said Steve Davis will remain in charge until then. I mean, because of the World Cup, that isn't that many games. But I suppose the thing is, Robin, you can't just keep saying to Steve Davis, well, you're also a fan, so this must be like a fun little thing for you to do.
<You know? laughs> Yeah. It's a bit patronising, isn't it? It's not looking great, is it? The sort of aimless managerial search, and they'll just see who's kind of left after the World Cup, maybe. There was a tweet that made me laugh from Daniel Story. He said, very mutinous mood at Molineux now, with chance for Scott Sellers, the technical director, to be sacked. Because you can't say sack the manager because he's gone. They just moved out. I mean, I don't know idea who Scott Sellers is, but obviously Wolves fans were just like...
He's a Culverhouse staple.
Newcastle.
Former...
Newcastle.
Was he Blackburn? Did he play Blackburn for a while?
I think so.
I suppose you can't technically sack Georgie Mendes, can you? Because he's not officially got a job, so...
No. But it's like we need to call someone to be sacked when we're losing. who's the first person that comes to mind?
I mean, that was a bad result for Wolves, obviously, but I don't think they're that bad. I mean, they just can't fucking score goals. But apart from that, and I know scoring goals is quite important.
I think they had a higher XG, actually, than Leicester yesterday. Diego Costa had quite a few chances, didn't he? And the other thing is, I think I saw Jamie Vardy, that was his 100th Premier League goal since turning 30.
That is some achievement. And also doing the "you're smelly" celebration. I mean, that is route one, isn't it? West Ham play Bournemouth tonight. We'll talk about that on Wednesday's pod at Champions League this week. The Guardian Women's Football Weekly will obviously talk about the World Cup draw in much more detail. But Robin, briefly, England will face Denmark, China and either Haiti or Chile. The Republic have got a tricky group, which includes Canada and Australia, as well as Nigeria. Have you plotted England's route to the final?
No, I'm not someone who does that because my brain doesn't work that way. But I'm told that it's a fairly kind group stage for England. But those who do plot it could be a tricky last 16, either Australia or Canada. But I think that's all very presumptuous about England winning the group and others coming second in other groups. So we'll just see how it is. Is Australia and New Zealand excited, Max?
Yes, I think so. Oh, that's interesting when people ask you that question. I think somebody wanted to ask me, you know, how Australia was reacting to some big news story. And I was like, well, I'm just in my living room. Like, it's not, I'm not doing like a massive survey. I'm not working for Ipso Mori or whatever it is, just surveying Australians. Like, I'm quite excited. I think I might be in the UK for it. I'm not sure. Do you want to rent my flat, Robin? Well, you can have it. I don't, you know, be generous about this. Are you over there? I can have it.
That is TBC.
All right. Okay.
We're still
God,
not absolutely
sure.
Got
your shoe in for that, haven't you, after the final of the Euros.
We'll see.
Listen, we have gone on far too long and producer Joel is yelling at me, but Nick, you wanted Ipswich Corner. Stu says, how far can Ipswich go with Kieran McKenna? Give us your best tight minute on Ipswich Town.
Yes, welcome to Ipswich Corner, this much-loved staple of Football Weekly. Very, very glad to bring it back. How far can I go under Kieran McKenna? He's done a fantastic job. The football is tactically, physically and technically way above League One level, I would say, with a team that's probably about half Championship-level players. That doesn't get you out of the division, obviously, because teams can just kick lumps out of you and get down the other end. But it's looking very good. He's reinvigorated a fan base that had been pretty apathetic. They had 28,500 in there the other night against Derby. I think 27,000 the week before, averaging about 25 in your fourth season in League One is pretty incredible. Certainly the vibe around the town and the stadium is better than I've seen it since they were in the Premier League 20 or so years ago, and it just shows what there is to be reawakened by packaging things up well and giving fans something they want to see. And I think while Ipswich is quite a small town of 140,000 odd, Suffolk itself has a population of I think just below 800,000, and then you've got a bit of North Essex too, so the potential catchment area where there isn't
a lot
much
of tractors, isn't it? It's a lot of tractors.
There are a lot of tractors clogging up the road on their way in to join the 28,000. So two more things. They, on Friday night against Derby, they played in a blow to the traditionalists, including me, in an all-black kit, which is, I mean, obviously Ipswich playing blue and white, but they played all black in a kit that was, I think, released in collaboration with Ed Sheeran. So that was the kind of marketing wheeze that people that can work well but doesn't necessarily go down well in some quarters. The other is that we can feed this into a wider Football League point if we want.
No, about... I don't care. It's too long. You've done your job and well done. You're not in any context. It's Ipswich Corner. It's not the rest of Football Corner. Finally, at the end of the pod on Thursday, Barry, you joked that by the time the pod went out, Liz Truss would have resigned. We actually beat the announcement by 45 minutes. So there we go. I mean, fuck knows we'll be Prime Minister by the time this one comes out. But maybe there will be one. We don't know. Maybe they'll just give it to Steve Davis until 2023.
But I'd settle for that.
Yeah.
That'll do for today's podcast. Thank you, Nick.
Thank you, Max.
Cheers, Robin.
Thanks, Max.
Thanks, Barry.
Cheers.
We'll be back on Wednesday. Football Weekly was produced by Joel Grove. Our executive producer is Danielle Stevens.
This is The Guardian. We'll be right back.